Well, before I get started on what we're going to talk about this morning, totally unrelated to anything I'm going to say here, I just want to thank Ron and Paul, I guess, helped them out for what it was a great evening last Sunday night. Those of you who didn't sign up for it, you missed out on a great time of hanging together with other couples and then having some good couple time ourselves. And Diane and I fully enjoyed it and had a great time to doing that. I hope if you passed up this opportunity, next time we do something similar, that you don't miss out on experiencing that. It actually does fit in with what I'm going to talk about today, because I'm talking about a sense of community. But as I was getting ready for this, I was thinking back to what seems now like a past life. I am not saying I believe in reincarnation, okay? But it seems distant to go, because I've been a pastor now for a little bit over 30 years. Excuse me. And previous to that, I was a transit operator, which is really just a sophisticated, elegant way of saying I was a bus driver here in the city of Vancouver. Enjoyed the job. Had a blast doing it. But along the way, I discovered when I would meet people and they would find out what I did for a living, they would proceed to tell me their greatest horror story that involved bus drivers and buses. And I found myself often trying to apologize for those things. And then after a while, you just become a little bit cynical. So then I developed different answers. I would say, you know what? They don't let us out of training until we learn to leave you behind just as you get to that front door. We practice that, and we practice the timing of, of hitting those puddles of water as people are walking by. We kind of slow down, and we just hope that there's somebody walking by right in there so we can kind of scream in there and shower them with some slush. Now, confession, I remember one time doing it and getting great joy out of it, and actually just even as I remember it now, it just fills me with intense, probably somewhat sinister satisfaction. Because what would happen is, when it would snow in Vancouver, especially when by schools, you became the target for all manner of snowballs. Really, guys, if you can't hit the bus, you probably can't even hit the side of a barn, okay? So it's not like it's a great target. But I was going by Killarney School. If anybody's listening into this and they ever went to Killarney School back in the late 70s, you might have been in that group that got sprayed. And I saw this group of guys just lining up, but they were a little bit ignorant about where they stood. And there was about a half a lane of slush kind of steady, stretching out from the curb lane out into half the lane. And I thought, I just can't pass this up. And I just swung over just as I went by. And I just got them good. Felt really good for change for payback. I know that was before my kind of walk with Jesus days, and at that time revenge really felt really good. Today, well, I probably still feel good, but it's not supposed to. So I would hear all these horror stories, and maybe in your job or your profession, as a teacher or perhaps as a lawyer or as somebody who works in the medical profession. Whatever, you work as an accountant. As soon as people find out what you do for a living, they proceed to tell you their worst experience with somebody in that profession, don't they? Well, like I said before, I've been now a pastor for a little over 30 years. And I've discovered nothing has really changed, except for I don't hear the horror stories about being a bus driver anymore. I hear about everybody's bad story, bad experience with the church. And believe me, there are enough. And, it seems like everybody has a story. And in particular, they seem to have a story of what was a very negative experience of church, or at least if it wasn't theirs, it was somebody else's. Now, I got to say that most of the time, they actually gain a pretty sympathetic ear, because I have a story like that as well. In fact, when I was about 18 years old, I'd come from Ecuador, had arrived and kind of been here about a year, was trying to adjust to life here. I got to admit to being somewhat of a very critical, judgmental, idealistic youth, and I saw the materialism of people lived with, And because I could put names and faces to families back home in Ecuador that were hard-pressed to put a meal on the table every day, it kind of set me off when I saw people driving up in their big cars and their fur coats to church on Sunday morning. I was kind of like one of the disciples sitting in the old back and saying, wouldn't that money be better spent on the poor? But I think things came to a climax in my life when one Sunday morning after youth Sunday school, I was sitting with a friend in the basement of the church, the lower auditorium area of the church, right after a class. And my friend was going through some really tough times, and I just was giving him a listening ear. That's all I could. I mean, I didn't have any greater wisdom than he did. And lo and behold, if an elder of the church didn't walk by and thought, at least made a judgment call on the fact that we were skipping out of being in the service, which had already started, and proceeded to tear a strip off our hides for doing what he thought we were doing. I walked out of that church that Sunday morning, and I didn't go back. In fact, I didn't go back to church for about 12 years. The only time I went back was for the rehearsal before my wedding and my wedding day. And it occurs to me that people can develop a very negative experience out of just one thing that happens in church. It has caused me to question now as a pastor of a church. You know, where I realized, for me at the age 18, it was, again, I was being idealistic and critical and judgmental. I'll acknowledge that. But what I thought was hypocrisy in those who were there. But also what it seemed to me is that you had to commit intellectual suicide in order to be a Christian, because I had all my questions and I was a skeptic, and I was not getting the answers that I thought would be valid. In fact, it seemed to be I was being negated the right to ask questions. I've always wanted in our church that this would be a safe place to not believe the way we believe and to ask all the questions you have, and not to offer pat answers, because those just don't hold water to the inquiring mind. But the long and the short of it is, I ended up in 12 years of my life in a wilderness of my own making, admittedly so, until eventually, through a series of circumstances in my life, I found my way back to faith and found my way back to Jesus. But as I've come into pastoring the church, and it wasn't something that I was even wanting to do, we were thinking we were headed overseas as missionaries when we sensed God's calling on our lives, and it's a bit of a strange twist of fate here, if you want to call it that, or providence, I guess, that God has us here as pastor. But as I've thought about it, I've had to question, I've wanted to consider, what is it, I know I've asked this question before, what is it that God has in mind when he thinks church? What was Jesus thinking? What did he have in mind? What was his vision when he said, I will build my church? See, I suspect, in fact, I think I'm pretty sure, it wasn't very much like what we experience as church. I think we've come to confuse church as a place to go to, or an organization that is there to meet and to serve our needs. I don't think that's anything close to what Jesus had in mind when he was talking about building his church. And so today, as we talk about what it means to be a follower of Jesus, one of the things that has come to my mind is that as I've studied this and looked into it and wrestled with it, is that there is a place for church, but not church necessarily as we know it. And I know that sounds strange coming from a pastor, because after this is what I do for a living. But I think that Jesus had in mind was a community of followers of his, living his way of life and following his way of life and living out his purpose and his mission in life. And I'm not too sure, not just our church, but how much churches in general actually live that out and accomplish that. I'm just asking the question right now, and my point is to kind of disturb our thinking so that we move off the status quo. Because remember, we've talked about this, I started talking about this at the beginning of this series, is to say, when this pandemic is over and the dust settles on everything, what will church be like? And I think the pandemic has given us this great opportunity that I'm afraid that most churches will pass up. A great opportunity to rediscover what it means to be truly be the church of Jesus Christ, the body of Jesus Christ, the community of followers of Jesus Christ in the world today, and to reinvent themselves in a way that they become more effective at being exactly what God has called us to be as church. And my fear is that we will go back to business as usual, and believe me, please don't take this wrong, but I hear this so often. I hear people longing to, what is it, when can we get back to worship, and when can't be, and we see churches violating the policies that have been put in place by our medical health, our provincial health officer, because they're more concerned about themselves and what they want to experience than about the greater community and how they impact the world around them. And they are now, those churches that are insisting on meeting right now are negatively impacting this world for Jesus. Shame on them. So I think we can begin to correct our understanding of church, because that's where it all starts out. It starts out with an incorrect, an improper, inappropriate, wrong understanding of what church is meant to be, what the church is. Because we're living out what we think church to be. And I'm convinced that if we can correct that understanding, we can begin to live out what the church is meant to be in Jesus' understanding and Jesus' calling. And I think in order to gain that better understanding, we need to wrestle with and grasp what Jesus intended and intends his church to be. Understand what it means to be and look like, what we intend to look like as a community of followers of Jesus. You see, the call to follow Jesus is a call to live in community with other followers. It's a call to be part of his community of followers. That isn't optional. There aren't any lone rangers that are followers of Jesus. You can't follow Jesus alone. I know sometimes circumstances in life in different parts of the world particularly determine that you feel very much alone and you're off that way. But that is not God's intention for followers. That is not Jesus' intention for followers of his followers. And if we go back into the beginning of his ministry, right at the beginning of chapter 4, right in chapter 4 of the Gospel of Matthew, where after his baptism and after he had been through the whole testing time in the wilderness, it says now he began to go through around the whole area around there, around Capernaum and around Nazareth and that area, and he began to call disciples. He's walking by the shores of the lake, and he sees Andrew and Peter out there fishing, and he calls them. He says, come follow me. He sees James and John, and he says, come follow me. Notice that the call to follow Jesus, there's three significant things that we can't overlook that our requirements are part of God's calling, Jesus' calling on us to be his followers. One is to be with them. Come, he says, come be with me. The second one is to become like him. God's intention for our lives in terms of as we grow to spiritual maturity, as we grow to maturity in general, is for us to become more like Jesus. And so Jesus, when he calls his followers, is for them to be with him and for them to be like him. But not only that, because often that's where we leave it. And we treat the third part as a third calling for some, but not for all. But that's not the case. There's just one calling. and that is to follow Jesus. And this third part of it is to do what he was doing. And to do what he is doing in the world, to be part of his purpose and what he's doing. And so he says, come follow me and I will make you fishers of men. Now I know our tendency here is to look at that statement or that phrase, fishers of men, and we see a nice play on words by Jesus. And I think he probably was doing that because he sees these are fishermen. And he doesn't really use that same phrase apparently with anybody else who he called to follow him. But there's a deeper significance to that phrase, fishers of men, which I just discovered this week in terms of my study. And that is that it was an idiom that was often used, sometimes used by rabbis in Jesus' time, where they would call people to be with them, to become like them, to do what they're doing, to capture the hearts and minds of others to be his disciples. And I think that's what Jesus has in mind when he says, come, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. He's saying, come, and just like I am here to capture the hearts and minds of men and women and youth and children to become part of the kingdom, so I want you to do the same thing. You will become fishers of men the same way. But to answer that call, they had to leave what they were doing. Now, I realize that today, it doesn't mean that all of us have to physically leave the job that we have. But it's to do what we're doing, to live our life with a different perspective. Because up until that point, James and John and Peter and Andrew, they were fishermen. And what did they live for? They lived to catch what they could, to feed their families, and to just get ahead in life and to cover the bills. Does that not describe so many people today? Maybe it describes you and me as well. We go to work so we can make a salary, get paid, so we can pay the bills, we can get food on the table, we can put our kids hopefully through school and maybe even through university, and we can get ahead and try to make headways in life, and life becomes centered around us, and we can go about it, we can be good people, we can do good jobs, we can do good things. But I believe that Jesus' calling to his followers, to his disciples, if we would follow him, is to a higher calling in life, is to make his mission and his purpose of establishing the kingdom of God our ultimate purpose, and to become fishers of men, to be people who capture the hearts and minds of men and women and youth and children who we come in contact with in our ordinary everyday lives, to draw them into the kingdom as well and to tell them the good news about Jesus. Well, that kind of thing takes place in community. And we're going to get to that here in a little while. It was a call that he put out there. He says to live with him. But I take note that, you know, Jesus didn't kind of call one or two and leave it at that. I mean, he ended up with 12 disciples that lived with him, that ate with him, you know, slept in around the campfire probably with him, traveled with him. And he's calling people, he says, to be a follower of him is also a call to be part of his community. And that is not optional. Well, community, it turns out, our experience of community is actually a vital human need that we have. We were created, and I know this is almost cliche to say this in church because we understand this, we quote it all the time, we were created to live in relationship with God and with each other. And that's the sense of community. That's community, with to live in that kind of community with God and with each other. And when we look into Genesis, the account, this poetic account of creation, we see that the writer of Genesis says that God created human beings, he created man and woman, and he created them in his own image. And by creating them in his own image, there's a couple things going on here. One is, yes, he's created them in his own image so that they have this connection with him. But more importantly, we were created in his own image to be God's representatives here on earth than to take care of this planet, take care of this earth of which we have done a crappy job. Because in the account that we find in the second chapter of Genesis, it says that he put a garden in there and he put the man in there to look after it. But community is more than a spiritual thing. It's hardwired right into our human psyche, right into our brains. The child that is developing in the womb of his mother or her mother is already being wired for that sense of community and that bonding with mom. And even the way that mother feels about carrying that child will be transmitted to that child, and whether that child begins to bond or feel even rejected by the mother. We are hardwired for community. One is a psychological theory that's advanced in support of this. It's called the belongingness theory. It states that human beings have this need to belong in some kind of community. And I put it there in your notes, a quote from professors and researchers Roy Baumeister and Mark Leary. They conclude that deprivation of stable, good relationships has been linked to a large array of aversive and pathological consequences. Big words. People who lack belongingness suffer higher levels of mental and physical illness and are relatively highly prone to a broad range of behavioral problems ranging from traffic accidents to criminality to suicide. It therefore seems appropriate to regard belongingness as a need rather than simply a want. We have this need to experience community. And when we don't experience a healthy community, we find unhealthy communities to belong to. That's the formation of gangs. In fact, much of what we experience in our world today as terrorism is people finding a common bond that they have as a community. Unfortunately for them, it has become a negative one where it's who we hate out there as opposed to who we include. Because healthy communities are inclusive, not exclusive. And they look to draw people in and to be beneficial in a positive way. We don't find healthy communities to be involved in, then we will find unhealthy ones to belong to as well. So what is community? What are we talking about? And I think it's important to clarify this, because we can mistake some pseudo-communities for community, or we can kind of shortchange what is real true community and then think we're experiencing it. I'll get to that later. Well, Merriam-Webster, the dictionary, defines it as the people of common interests living together in a particular area, a group of people with a common characteristic and interest living together within a larger society. And all these parts are really important when we want to understand what it means to be part of a community. It's a common interest. In other words, people living in a community have something in common. Notice that they live together within proximity in a particular area. That is really important. They have some kind of common characteristic. And they can be a smaller community within a larger society, but they have something common and they live in common. They live together. Social psychologist Sherry Turkle, who's done a lot of research and working at the way technology has affected our experience of community and relationship, says communities are constituted by physical proximity. I want you to take note of that. Physical proximity, shared concerns, real consequences, and common responsibilities. All these things are really important as we begin to try to understand community, what it means to be part of the community of followers of Jesus. The biblical word that is often used in reference to community or to describe Christian community is the Greek word koinonia. It's often translated as fellowship. Unfortunately, we have a very weak and watered-down idea of fellowship, and often we just think it as food and fun with friends. But it's so much more than that, because fellowship carries a sense of partnership, of being working together for a common cause and a common purpose, actively engaged in something that you have in common, a mission, a common mission. This isn't sitting around passively sharing a meal, but it's sharing a meal to build that relationship so that you can actively engage and work towards a common purpose. Community into which Jesus calls us can be defined, and I've come across John Mark Comer, pastor of Bridgetown Church in Portland, Oregon, who's got some very good teaching on community. He says it. He defines it as intentional relationships around the way of Jesus. I like that, because here we're talking in this series about what it means to live the Jesus way. And a community of followers is intentional, note that word, intentional relationships of followers who are living around the way of Jesus. Well, let's talk for a minute here about the importance and significance of community in the lives of the followers of Jesus, that we can understand why Jesus called people into community, why it's so important in our lives today to experience that, and why it's vital, not optional, but significantly important and vital for followers of Jesus to live together in community. Community is the context in which we experience transformation and growth into the likeness of Jesus. Apart from that, our growth will be very negligible at best. We experience transformation, we experience this kind of growth as we live together in community, we work together in community, we share in our lives together in community. And there's three ways that I've come across that I think help us do that. I'll start out with the toughest one, and I want to call it exposure. Because when we live together with others and we begin to be transparent about who we are, we begin to discover what probably others see long before we see it in ourselves, what I'll refer to as our shadow side. We all have one. If you don't think you have one, it's just you're not aware of what your shadow side is. We all have one. Pete Scazzaro, who's done a lot of work in terms of healthy emotional relationships, emotional spirituality, defines it as the damaged but mostly hidden side of who you are. You see, we are often blind to the shadow side, and we need others who will lovingly call it to our attention to it so that we can actually deal with it and do something about it. Your shadow side might be the shadow side of your strengths taken to a great extreme. There's all kinds of ways that those things show up. You may be a perfectionist, and out of your perfectionism, you're critical and judgmental, and it's no longer about striving for the best, but being critical about others for not giving their best, what you would perceive to be their best. You don't tolerate errors. You don't tolerate mistakes. We need to be together in a group where we have that sense of trust, that sense of being loved, that sense of caring, so we can risk showing who we really are on the inside, and we can be called in a loving way to account for that and for making those changes and allowing the Spirit of God to transform us. Do you have a friend? Somebody who you would trust and you would accept anything they said to you as coming from love? Do you have somebody who would be able to speak truth into your life and not get a negative and adverse reaction of anger that lashes out at them for saying that? It's when we experience genuine community with others and we've learned to trust them and to experience, we've opened ourselves up to experience love, that we can begin to deal with those shadow, the shadow side of our life, and those things that lurk beneath the surface that often are hidden from our sight, but really not from anybody else's. I think the second way we grow in community is through this mutual sense of encouragement. I call it positive accountability. And it's encouragement that comes in words as well as action that keeps us going, especially when life is tough. We can celebrate together our accomplishments and our achievements, but we can also celebrate even that minimal progress that takes place, perhaps in beating an addiction or moving a step forward or making some changes in our lives. We can celebrate these things together as we journey through life. And we all need those words of encouragement. We all need those actions that celebrate those forward steps that we make as we deal with, as we go through life. I think the third way we experience growth and transformation is through healing. Because the reality is we all come into our Christian journey with baggage and carrying a certain amount of hurts from wounds and hurts from the past. And just because we accept Jesus into our lives and we turn our lives over to Him doesn't mean that those things automatically get healed and everything gets dealt with and now somebody pushes the delete button and all those things are wiped away and gone. I wish it were so. But transformation is a process. And God often uses other people to help us experience that healing, to bring us along the way, to walk through with us through that journey of healing, to help us understand where those hurts might be. That maybe some of those are the hurts that are contributing to the shadow side of our life as well. But it's a healing that can only take place in a loving and caring environment of a community of followers of Jesus that are committed to living the Jesus way in their lives. So that's just to highlight the importance and the significance of community in our lives. And again, to go back to the very first thing is that if we are to be followers of Jesus, it is not optional to be part of that. We can only become followers of Jesus and live that out in our everyday lives as we become part of this community of people who are on journey with Jesus and living the Jesus way. Well, without question, there's challenges along the way in terms of what it takes to become part of that type of community. And so I just want to highlight some of these and realize that some of these, as we talk about them, probably some are going to create a measure of discomfort in your life. And I want you to know I'm okay with that. And I'm okay when you push back on some of them. The only thing I would say is when you find yourself pushing back on something that I'm going to say in this next little stretch, I just would call you to say, take some time to step back, push the pause button, and reflect on why you are pushing back on that one, because it may tell you something about yourself that you haven't been ready to recognize about yourself, and that might be something that's holding you back from further growth in your life. Some of these, we may not even be aware of to the fullest extent that they affect our lives. And the first one is what is individualism. I think it's the air we breathe in our North American, our Western culture, our Western developed world culture, if you like. It's that sense that the individual is more important than the community. And we see that all around us where we have enshrine the rights of the individual in our what we call the Charter of Rights, and often the rights of the individual take precedence over what is best for the community. And so we have this sense that the individual is more important, and we claim our rights, don't we? Even when we know that it is legally our right to claim that, but it may do damage to others as well, but it's still my right, and we claim it. Well, individualism, a person to join and to become part of the community of faith, the community of followers of Jesus, needs to be able to give up those individual rights and place the rights of others the benefit of others ahead of theirs. Paul writes this in Philippians. He says, do nothing, that means nothing, out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. But in humility, consider others better than yourself. Each of you should look not only to your own interests. Notice he's not saying you don't need to look out for your interests at all. But he says, don't just exclusively look out for your own interests, but also the interests of others. Ephesians, and I didn't put this in here, but Ephesians 5:21, a pivotal verse before Paul launches into talking about what it means to live in relationship as husbands and wives, what it means to live in relationship as parents with children, what it means to live in relationship between masters and slaves, which in our day would be employers and bosses and employees. He puts this pivotal statement and he says, submit yourselves one to another out of reverence for Christ. That means literally put somebody else over top of you, put their needs ahead of your needs. By the way, I can always recognize the serious issues that begin to crop up in a marriage when I meet with a couple and I hear each one saying, he or she no longer meets my needs or is not meeting my needs. And see, with all due respect to those who may be experiencing something similar, marriage, what makes a marriage work is not looking for your needs to be met, but looking for how you meet the needs of the other person. I hear some people say, well, marriage is a 50-50 proposition. It is not. It's 100%. It's each one of you giving 100%. And when we live in community as followers of Jesus, it's not a matter of what's in it for me. It's not a consumer approach to church that says, how is this church going to serve my needs? Remember what I said at the beginning. We have this mistaken notion that church exists to serve my needs and to meet my needs. And I have these kids that need to be taken care of. I need a children's program. I need a youth program. And by the way, it's great to have a great music program. This is what I'm looking for at church. These are all good things. But they shouldn't be the primary question that you're asking when you choose a community of faith, a church that you would want to be part with. You need to instead be asking, what do I bring? What can I bring? What can I contribute to the life and ministry of this community of followers of Jesus? Individualism inevitably leads to that spirit of entitlement that we see so commonly around us today. And sometimes wrongfully, I hear older generations accusing a younger generation of having that spirit of entitlement. And again, I know I'm approaching this age. Some would say you're already there. That I watch people who get on in years, and as they get older, the filters come off, don't they? I mean, if you're in this age group of kind of, I'm approaching 70, so I'll say above 70. And you feel you're entitled to say whatever's on your mind because, after all, you're old and wise. That's not true at all. I almost said something else, but I won't. It's just not true. You don't have any greater entitlement to speak your mind just because you want to get something off your chest. And I hear people saying this. I speak my mind, and I do so in love. And I'm thinking, no, you don't. Because you were just trying to get something off your chest. And by the way, if you're one of these people that seems to always need to give everybody else a piece of your mind, the end result of that is to end up totally mindless because you've given it all away. And I think that probably explains a lot of people these days that seem to simply speak their mind because they keep on giving their mind away and they really are mindless and thoughtless. Individualism inevitably leads to a spirit of entitlement. It says, I'm exclusive. We separate ourselves from the overall group. Have we not seen that over those last few months by those who hold positions of power, who seem to feel like they're entitled to travel, when nobody else is, when they're telling everybody else to stay home. That's a spirit of entitlement that comes from the individualism that comes to say, to remove yourself and to be separate from the community overall and say what is good for the community is not necessarily what I need to follow because my individual rights supersede that. Individualism inevitably leads to that spirit of entitlement. Jesus was teaching his disciples, and he had noticed at one point, Mark tells us, that as they were walking down the road, there had been, I would imagine Jesus was in front and most of them were behind him following him, and he had noticed that there had been an argument going on behind him. And so I guess someplace they'd stopped to rest or stopped for the day, and he turns to him and says, "So what were you arguing about?" Well, he knew darn well what they were arguing about. What they were arguing about, Mark says, is who is the greatest? That's really mature. And so then he turns and says, "Well, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all." It's apparently a lesson that didn't sink in very well. Actually, I sometimes take great comfort in looking at the disciples and reading about them as how hard of learning they were, because it gives me a sense of, well, there's hope for me, even though I don't quite learn my lessons the hard way as quickly as I should. And I say they probably didn't seem to have learned their lesson very well, because in the very next chapter we find that John and James, and actually if we read Matthew's account, that it's their mommy that comes to Jesus, and John and James are what Jesus called the sons of thunder, but here they have their mother going to Jesus and making a special request. She says, you know, Matthew says she gets down on one knee type of thing and is being very humble. And Jesus said, "Well, what can I do for you?" And she says, "Well, could you make sure that one of my boys is on your right and one of my boys is on your left?" In other words, make them your top leaders and commanders or whatever when you come in your kingdom. Well, when the rest of the group, the other 10, find out about this, they're pretty ticked off, as most of us would probably would be when we realize that somebody in the group is trying kind of pull strings to vie for that top position. Jesus turns to them and says, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you." In other words, that is not what's going to happen here. I will not allow it. It does not take place. "Instead," he said, "whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all, to all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." See, Jesus invites us to be part of his community so that we can become like him. And that means in becoming like him, we give up our rights. We don't claim these individual rights to be first, to be, you know, to be the best, to be the greatest. But we see ourselves and we look for ways to serve the needs of others. Well, there's an unwillingness at times that grows out of that individualism of being committed to the community of Christ. And that word committed is such an important part of genuine community. We talked last Sunday about commitment and what it means, so I'm not going to kind of launch into all that. But we have this fear of commitment. We don't like to be committed. And I think part of it is we want to keep our options open, don't we? You know, there's a sense that if I become committed to this, and now I got to be called, I publicly make a commitment to this sort of thing, now I can be called account for that. But you know, if something else comes up, I can't do that or I can't go there. Commitment says you put all your eggs in one basket and say, "I'm here. I'm dedicated to this." Jesus' call to follow him is to be committed to his community, to place that first. And I put a note in there about why I think this is difficult in our culture, because we have what most sociologists would refer to as a weak group culture. That means this is out of where our individualism grows out of, is that we have weak commitment to the group as a whole. That shows up in the breakdown in our marriages. It shows up in our breakdown in families. It shows up in a lack of loyalty to the places that we work. There's this very weak group commitment. There's a weak sense of commitment to anything apart from what is in my best interests. Compare that to a strong group society, which is actually pretty much any other society besides North American and Western European societies, where family is significantly important and there's a high sense of shame and honor that comes into play into how you relate, and you put your family first. You do what's first for them. Jesus' call is to be fully committed to his community. And he even placed this in when he says in a sense of you, no one who doesn't hate his mother and father or his brother and sister can't be my follower. And he's not saying you got to go out and hate them, but he says, in contrast, your first loyalty, your first commitment has to be to me and my community. When couples get married, and let me use marriage again, there's that transfer of loyalty that needs to take place from parents or from the home, from anything else, to say my first loyalty is now to my spouse, to my husband or my wife. That's where my first loyalty lies. When that is weak, to the extent that that is weak, the marriage becomes weak as well. Well, that covers the whole sense of individualism, which is so much a part of society, and we needed to kind of talk about that here for a minute. I think, and I'm just going to touch a little bit on this and then move on. I think busyness and personal priorities and materialism also weaken our ability to be part of, to be willing to be committed to a community of the community that Jesus is calling us to. You know, in Luke 9, 57 to 62, and we looked at this previously, so I won't go a lot into this, but there's several different examples where Jesus calls somebody to follow him, and they say, well, first I need to do this. First I need to bury my father. First I need to go say goodbye over here. And what he's saying is, you need to not set other excuses up, but come right away. Notice that in the telling of those stories, Luke doesn't tell us what the individual decided. He left it open-ended. And I think he intentionally does that because it leaves it up to us to find our place in the story and decide how we would answer that question. So we can let business and personal priorities and materialism stand in the way of being committed to the community of Jesus. Let me hit on one, and I believe this one is probably going to touch a sore point with some people, and some of you are going to say, oh yeah, there goes Don again off on social media. So let me just dive in here, and you can send me your emails if you like. I think that in this day and age, a big deterrent for people making a commitment to the community of followers of Jesus to live the Jesus way is technology. We live in a computerized time, and it's not just computers, but technology of any kind occupies us, becomes an obsession in many ways. And among those is social media in a very significant way. Loneliness, by all measures, is on the increase in our world today, and that was before the pandemic struck. I realize it's become exponentially higher through this time because we feel, and many people feel, isolated from others, and I can understand that. And so loneliness has gone up exponentially in this last year. But it was already greatly on the increase before that. So much so that in Great Britain, the previous year, in 2019, they appointed a minister of loneliness. Can you believe that? A minister of loneliness. That means that they recognize that this was a problem in their society, in their culture, in their nation, that needed a specific person to address it to figure out what they do about it. Research shows that there's a connection between this increase in the experience of loneliness and the increased amount of times that we are spending online, and particularly on social media. I know that there's an expectation that it should be the opposite. And there's people who say, well, social media is my social outlet. But I'm just telling you that research shows that there seems to be this direct connection. They haven't quite outlined and determined why, and that'll take greater, more amount of research. I suspect that there's a couple things going on here. One is people become addicted to social media. People become addicted to being online. And you can judge for yourself how many hours you spend online and in social media. You can figure that out. And every hour, the time that you spend on social media, this person spends on social media, is time that is taken away from spent with real people that might even be present in your home right then and there in real relationships. So I think that's part of it. Another possibility here, and one that's been pointed out in one of the studies that I read, was that social media highlights the absence of real friends, of real people in our lives. And so it accentuates. It's like it's staring you in the face because you have all these relationships online. Or, and this is what often happens, we're comparing our everyday lives to somebody's highlight reel about what they're doing on holidays and where they're going and what's taking place. And we find ourselves stuck away in isolation in our room back home, and we can't travel. Whatever it is, we have mistaken the notion that we have an online community. And by definition of how we've looked at how we define how community is defined, not only by us, but not only by myself here, but by sociologists and psychologists, and how community is defined, is that social online community actually becomes an oxymoron, a contradiction in terms, and I think works against real community taking place. Mother Teresa, and this obviously goes back a lot of years, so loneliness has been around for a long time, has said loneliness is the leprosy of the modern world. We easily confuse connectivity with community, and the two are not the same. They're not synonymous. Now, I want to recognize that in the time we're in right now, that connecting online, and I meet with a small group on Wednesday nights online, and it is our experience of community. And we run our services. Obviously, you're listening to this online. That there's a sense that this is what needs to be done for now. I understand that. And I support it. And I decry those churches that don't support it, because I believe they're prolonging the time in which we can get back to being back together as a group and meeting in person. My concern and my fear is that when it's no longer necessary anymore, and we are given the green light to meet together as a person in churches for worship and instruction, in our homes for small group study, and to engage in and to be involved in each other's lives, how many will choose the passive way out and say, "This works for me. I'm going to stay home." And I believe it'll be detrimental to them if they do that, because I believe that we grow better together when we are in person together, exchanging in each other's lives, where we have face-to-face, heart-to-heart interactions and conversations. We need to remember that virtual, when we talk about virtual community, virtual means as close to the real thing without being the real thing. That's really what it means. And let me remind you that the greatest deception takes place, that Satan sends our way, is when something appears to be truth, and it is so close to the truth that we think it's a truth, but it's a lie. Technology takes up our times. And not just in the sense of social media. How many times have you walked into a restaurant? We will go for lunch again today because this is our regular practice to support a local family-run operation up on Hastings. And I don't think there's a time where I haven't walked in there and there hasn't been another couple or another family there, and they're all on their cell phones. They're texting or they're playing games. In our home, you're not allowed a cell phone at the table. We use that time as interaction time to catch up in each other's lives and to engage in conversation. But technology, we become addicted to our screens. And we block everybody else out. I watch people walk down the street. And they're texting as they walk. Totally oblivious to anything going on around them. Worse yet, people text while they drive. Totally oblivious and causing any number of accidents. It's now a worse cause of accidents over impaired driving. Technology is something that is a challenge that we need to deal with in our lives today. Technology is good, but when it's misused, it's not so good. And it stands in the way of developing and being part of a true sense of community. The last thing I put there is that technology, when we go online, we can pretend to be anybody we like. But I think our way of dealing with conflict online is pretty bad too. Because, I mean, if you don't like somebody, what do? You don't like something somebody said, you block them, you unfriend them. You never seek resolution. When we are in community, it's not that there isn't conflict, there is conflict, and I'm going to get into this here in this last one where we talk about idealism. There's conflict, because whenever you put two people in a room together, wherever there's relationship, conflict is a natural byproduct of that relationship. And we can have unrealistic expectations of what church should be like and what it will be like. And there's a lot of people that keep moving from church to church because they've had a negative experience here, a negative experience there. They've never stayed long enough to work it through. We have this unrealistic expectation of others that, by the way, we often don't live up to ourselves. And the greater the gap is between this idealistic notion of what church should be like and our experience of church, the greater our sense of disillusionment and our sense of criticism and judgmental and condemnation. Let me kind of reflect on marriage again as the same thing. You see, if you go into marriage and you have this ideal, this very idealistic notion of what your marriage is going to be like, believe me, you're going to be disillusioned. Because you married a flawed person just like you are. And we all have our flaws and our failures. And we need to recognize that and work through those things. But if we maintain this ideal and say, this is what I expect my marriage to be every day, every hour of every day, our disillusionment will settle in and it will spell the end of that marriage relationship. See, the reality is that relationships are messy. If you haven't discovered that, you probably don't have very many close relations with anybody. They're messy because we are flawed people with our sense of our own failures and our character flaws. And conflict is just this natural byproduct of being in a relationship with others. I want to take you back to Matthew and look at the list of disciples, the people he lists out, and I'm just going to make a couple of comments on them, and then we'll move on. In chapter 10 of Matthew, and this is Matthew listing them, he says, these are the names of the 12 apostles. He says, first, Simon, who is called Peter, and his brother Andrew, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. I want you to notice that he, apart from Judas, who betrayed him, he puts qualifiers on only two people. One is himself. He says, Matthew, the tax collector. And then he talks about Simon the Zealot. Now, what you've put together is two people who couldn't be more opposite in terms of where they exist. Matthew, as a tax collector, was seen as a traitor. He was working for the Romans. He was collecting taxes for the Romans from his own people. He was viewed as somebody who's ripping off his own people, getting rich at their expense, and paying off the oppressors. Simon the Zealot was part of to put it mildly, was a terrorist group. They believed in domestic terrorism and finding ways to eliminate Romans, to fight back and to do so in a very clandestine way. I just want you to stop and think about this, okay? They're engaged in Bible study in your home. And you got Matthew and you got Simon sitting there. Or for Jesus, you know, they're traveling along the road and they sit down for a meal together. I wonder how closely those two guys sit together. And what they have in common. The reality is that relationships in the church and in the community of faith are messy. We are put with people that we would otherwise probably not come in contact with or have a whole lot to do. And I believe that's why some of these one another's are there in Scripture. And so Paul tells us to accept one another, just as Christ accepted you. That means unconditionally. He says to bear with each other. That means when you irritate me, I got to bear with it. When I irritate you, you got to bear with it. And then he goes on to say, and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. He's not leaving it open to exceptions of what you will forgive and what you won't forgive. And can I remind you that when we forgive, that love is part of forgiving, but as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, that love also does not keep a record of wrongs. Tough things to do, but that's what we are called to do as we live in community. Last one is that the challenge that we face in living in community together is a fear of rejection. It's like if I show you and tell you who I really am, if you get to know the real me, will you still like me? Will you still love me? But if we're to experience healing that we talked about, if we experience transformation and growth as we've talked about, we need to be transparent, we need to be vulnerable, we need to take the risk of showing who we really are. And it's only in that kind of context of loving and accepting community that we can truly be ourselves and work through those flaws and failures, celebrate our strengths, and experience healing and transformation in our lives and our process to growth. Well, I want to wrap it up here. I want to just bring it back to how we started our series, and that is to say, you're having a conversation with Jesus because he's asking you to define where you stand in your relationship with him. And he's talked a lot about the kingdom. He's talked about what that looks like and what it means to be part of that. He's talked about what it means to experience his love and to love others. And last week, we saw that he put the question finally to us and says, are you committed? And I think this week he's saying, and by the way, to be committed to me is to also be committed to each other as a community of followers of Jesus. See, to follow Jesus is to live in community with other followers and to work together with them to see the kingdom of God established on earth as it is in heaven. Because it's only as we are committed to that community, the community of other followers living the Jesus way, that we will begin to see His power unleashed in a life and a world that a life and world transforming way. Will you answer His call to be His follower and to be part of His community? When I opened, I talked about the negative stories that are out there about the church. You know, we can't counter all those, and we can't change what somebody's past experience has been like. But as a church of Jesus Christ that we call Brentwood Park Alliance Church, we can commit ourselves to being a community of followers living the Jesus way. That those who come through these doors and come into an experience of this church would say, oh, that's what it means. Well, that's what it's like. But I want to take that a little bit farther. You see, the church exists because we have a mission. And the mission is about going. And again, I think one of the mistaken notions that we have developed about church over the last probably centuries is a build it and they will come kind of approach. Well, the truth is they're not coming. And what's more, they don't want to come. So if we are to fulfill our mission, which is to make followers of Jesus Christ, invite people to be his followers just as we are, we need to go. The chances are the people you know, whether at work or in your community, that don't have a church that they call home and don't go, chances are pretty good they're not going to come here. They may not even come if you invite them. It'd be great if you did invite them, they came. But it's really as you build relationship with them, as you become community to them, that they'll begin to see in you the difference and learn what it means to be a follower of Jesus. So how about it? Let's take some time to rediscover who we are, who we are called to be as followers of Jesus. And let's then commit ourselves to living that out in our everyday lives and not just on Sunday morning. May God be honored through your life and through my life as we commit ourselves to being a community of followers of Jesus, living the Jesus way because we've come into an experience of His awesome love for us, and we experience the power of His Spirit empowering us to do what He's called us to do. May it be true in your life, in our life, in the life of our church. Peace be with you.